Seattle's Morning News, Aaron Mason filling in for Dave Ross. Before we celebrate our independence on July 4th, let's remember another pivotal moment in American history from July 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. Of course, I'm talking about the Battle of Gettysburg. CBS News military analyst and retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland is in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, for the annual remembrance. Good morning, Colonel.
Good morning to you, Aaron.
So, for those of us who are not buffed up on our American history as much as we may like to be, what was happening to the run-up to July of 1863?
Well, what's going on, of course, we described this in our new book, Battle Tested, with my colleague, Colonel Tom Vosloo. What was going on, of course, was the Confederacy. Obviously, they want to win the war, and the best way they can think to win the war would be allow Robert E. Lee to once again invade the North. He had done so in the fall of 1862. Which will result in the Battle of Antietam. They're hoping to get a decisive battle somewhere on northern territory, which might tip the scales politically in their favor. They realize there's going to be a presidential election in 1864. They further realize that Abraham Lincoln, frankly, is not very popular in the United States right now, not very popular even in his own political party, some of the Republican Party thinking that Lincoln should not be allowed to run for a second term. So if they can score that victory, they may tip the scales. Someone else then is elected president who would be willing to negotiate a settlement, and they'll gain their independence. And secondarily, they hope that another decisive victory, this time again on northern territory, might tip the scales internationally and encourage the British and or the French to recognize the Confederacy and perhaps intervene in their behalf. Now, don't forget, in 1863, we're only about 80 years from the end of the American Revolution, and they still recall that it is the intervention by the French fleet, and French soldiers that tip the scale at Yorktown and preserve the possibility for American independence.
If you'll indulge me, Colonel, in a little thought experiment, maybe some alternate universe historical fiction, what happens if the Union loses?
If the Union loses, of course, you can spin this out, and there are numerous books that do this. Of course, most of them, I think, conclude a couple of things. One, it's politically devastating to the North and perhaps compromises the possibility of Abraham Lincoln being reelected. Don't forget, in 1864, Abraham Lincoln's opponent on the Democratic side is a former Union general, George McClellan, who basically runs on a peace platform. So it seems to be that substantial opposition to the war, which does exist, with what comes out in his opponent. And obviously, a failure at Gettysburg might make that that strength of that opposition even that much stronger and negotiate a settlement. And furthermore, of course, there's the possibility of that recognition by the British and the French. More immediately, what could the Confederates have done? I don't think they had sufficient forces to capture Washington by this time. Washington is heavily protected by troops. Numerous forts surround the District of Columbia, the capital. Mm-hmm. So I don't think they could have captured Washington. Might then have been able to proceed on and take Harrisburg, probably. Could they have threatened other big cities in the North? Perhaps Baltimore, perhaps Philadelphia, maybe. But to some degree, the Confederates probably are going to score that victory and withdraw simply because they can't sustain themselves, I think, indefinitely on enemy territory, number one. And obviously, they're going to sustain an awful lot of casualties, even in success, that might make it more propitious for them, having scored those victories, then to withdraw and see what happens.
As I mentioned, sir, you are in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, this morning. What's the scene out there this weekend?
Well, seen out there, of course, is they'll have a series of reenactments. They have that on the first, second, third of the actual battle. Those obviously were postponed last year because of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of happiness that they will occur today and tomorrow and in a reduced scale. The weather's been a little rainy, so there's not quite as many people out here as I expected, but there's a good number. We also see the presence out here for these kind of celebrations of large numbers of reenactors, and there's about 10,000 mm-hmm. or more Civil War reenactors all across the country who will show up on these particular anniversaries in their Civil War regalia, uniforms, and muskets and what have you. Many of their spouses and girlfriends will show up in 19th-century-long hoop skirts worn by women at those times, and they'll actually do encampments at various sites throughout the battlefield.
How big are the biggest sideburns you've seen? Any impressive chops out there?
Oh, yeah, there's some pretty impressive chops and beards. There's no two ways about it, because obviously in the 19th century, facial hair on men was a lot more common. Right. Beards on men were very common, as opposed to now we see in the 21st century. And don't forget, you know, the term burn sides or side burn comes from a Union general by the name of Ambrose Burnside, who had enormous chops, and that's how the word sideburns was in fact created.
Oh, that's awesome. I didn't know that. Okay, so today we feel very divided here in this country, and we had the attack on the Capitol on January 6th. But I think, and I wonder if you do too, that it's important to remember that this is not the worst that things have ever been.
Oh, but absolutely correct. There's no doubt about it. I mean, one of the saddest things to me about Gettysburg is throughout the American Civil War, as best we can tell, about 650,000 people will die. Now, that's as best we can tell because the accounting is far from perfect. About half of them will die from the beginning of the war in April of 1861 until Gettysburg and the 4th of July, 1863. The other half, almost the person, will die from the 5th of July, 1863 until the end. And that shows you the depth of destruction that occurs in this horrific war, which accounted for more dead, I think, than all our other wars that we ever fought, number one. But number two, there was an opportunity, some believe, to end that war here in July of 1863, and that would have preserved, again, the lives of 300,000 people or more.
Yeah. That is CBS News military analyst, co-author of the book Battle Tested, and retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland. Thank you so much, Colonel, for sharing your time with us today.
Thank you, Aaron, and happy 4th of July.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington, an evergreen...
Our resident historian Felix Bunnell joins us Friday mornings for All Over the Map, a quick look at the stories behind the names of local places and things. And this week, the Northwest Candy Bar that honors its home state and that state's most famous export, the Idaho Spud. Good morning, Felix.
Good morning, Aaron. Yeah, we've talked here before about the Mountain Bar in Tacoma, Brown and Haley, Appleton Kotlets from Kashmir over in eastern Washington. This candy bar comes from a bit farther away, but it's been a fixture in stores in western Washington for as long as I can remember and probably decades before that. It's called the Idaho Spud. It's made by the Idaho Candy Company in Boise, and it goes back to at least 1918, perhaps a little earlier. The company makes some other more generic candies like peanut brittle and that sort of stuff. And the Idaho Spud Bar, it's a bit of a throwback to maybe the 1940s, when there were still a lot of regional candy companies and regional candy bars all over the U.S. Every region had its own sort of bars like the Idaho Spud. Now, I talked to CEO Dave Wagers earlier this week. He told me the whole story, and you know, he's really into it. He knows the history of the company very well. Go ahead and open yours up. I've got a sample there for you.
Yeah, here we go.
Now, you'll notice the package looks like a russet potato. It has potato eyes all over it. And now, to be really clear, there's no potato in an Idaho Spud. The backstory is Idaho is famous for potatoes, and the first potatoes were planted there by a missionary, a guy named Henry Spaulding, back in 1837. And by the 1870s or so, Idaho Territory was a player in shipping potatoes all over the West, and the state was known far and wide for its potatoes, probably by the 1890s or so. And in the most recent year for which stats are available, they ship something like 13 million pounds of potatoes a year. Washington is in second with about 10 million pounds, so we're pretty close to Idaho in terms of potato output. Now, the candy bar is believed to have been named by company founder T.O. Smith. Now, what is an Idaho Spud candy bar? Well, the core is a chunk of marshmallow. But it's not like a campfire marshmallow. There's no gelatin, only a seaweed extract, something called agar-agar.
Huh.
So you might notice the marshmallow, when you bite it, it breaks rather than stretches. I think I actually like that, and that's what's something that Dave Wagers told me about. Now, the marshmallow is covered with chocolate and then dusted with unsweetened coconut. So the whole thing, if you take it out, sort of looks like a potato except for the white coconut on it.
Sure, yeah.
Anyway.
Now, which is shedding a little bit.
Yeah, and now Dave Wagers told me they'll sell about 2 million of these Idaho Spud bars this year, and much of those sales are in the states around Idaho, you know, Utah, Montana, Oregon, and here in Washington, where I get mine at the Bartels. But the bulk, probably 60% or so, are sold actually in Idaho. That's sort of a big duh, right? If you live in Idaho, it makes sense to buy Idaho Spud bars. Mm-hmm. I don't think we have any candy that's named here for Washington. I could be wrong, but maybe there's some. I mean, there's Seattle chocolates and stuff like that, but we don't have a Washington State candy bar as far as I know. Now, in talking to Dave Wagers, whose family bought this company about 40 years ago, I didn't want to get all political, but we talked here on all over the map a few months ago about this movement that's underway to expand the borders of Idaho out to the Oregon coast.
Oh, right.
You know, rural Oregon, they want to be part of Idaho. That seems like a business opportunity for Idaho Spud. Now, Dave Wagers told me he's president of the Boise School Board, and he tries to avoid weighing in on political issues because he ends up getting into trouble. So I tried to appeal to him as a business owner.
If there truly is the bulk of your market is within the boundaries of a place called Idaho for an Idaho Spud Bar, you want all the states to become Idaho.
I should probably sponsor the movement, you know. It would make sense.
All right, well, let's see if we can't get you in trouble here with the school board. That'll be fun.
So I don't know what kind of listenership we have in Boise or if people will pick this up, but who knows? Dave Wagers might be in big trouble now for his support for the movement to expand the Idaho borders to Oregon. So what, have you had a chance to taste it?
Are you I can give it a whirl.
Oh, yeah, go ahead. Uh-huh, mm-hmm, what do you think? I mean, it's got it's chocolate, it's coconut, it's agar, marshmallow.
Well, you can taste that agar.
Yeah.
It's quite good. The marshmallow not pulling, I like a lot. The consistency is fluffy and gooey.
Yeah,
and it's not too sweet.
Exactly. It's unsweetened coconut, too. And it's made in the same factory it's been made in the whole time. And it's a little brick building there right in downtown Boise. We'll have some pictures at mynorthwest.com. And it's just one of these little regional products that's still hanging on. Dave Wager's family bought the business 40 years ago, and he has nephews who want to take over the company someday. So it's just one of these cool regional things that we love to celebrate here on All Over the Map.
Mm. Felix, well done. And thanks for the candy bar.
Sure, it's breakfast.
I love that. You mentioned peanut brittle earlier. Have you ever... Actually, anytime I see peanut brittle, it's always the snake gag. I've never actually seen a can of peanut brittle with peanut brittle in it. Thank you, Felix Bunnell, our resident historian. The U.S. military withdrawal from Afghanistan. Today, the last American troops left Bagram Air Force Base, the main headquarters for the nearly two-decade war. This comes amid a resurgence of the Taliban, currently in its spring offensive and gaining territory. So we called up CBS military analyst and retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland for more.
The Taliban appears to have been surprised. Spring offensives for the Taliban are pretty much the rule as the weather improves and they can move troops through the mountains from their strongholds, particularly in Pakistan. But this current spring offensive has gone far better than they ever imagined as the United States announced its withdrawal. And since the 1st of May, the Taliban has basically doubled the number of districts throughout the 34 provinces of Afghanistan that they control. And they now control about half of the districts throughout the country. The remainder are either being controlled by the government or contested, at least. So they have made substantial gains. And there have been some suggestions by some experts they may be slowing their advance because they don't want to interfere with the American withdrawal and perhaps slow that particular withdrawal. But they are making major gains. As a consequence, we see Afghanistan, which is a very multi-ethnic society, about 40% of the population is Pashtun, 40-45%, about 20-25% is Tajik, and then about 10% are Hazara and Uzbeks and other groups throughout the country. And as we see this particular war now going on, we see more fragmentation along ethnic lines. We also saw that happen when the Soviet Union withdrawed from Afghanistan, and more the warlords rising up to defend their own particular areas or their own particular ethnic groups. A good example, perhaps, the Hazaras, who are Shiites and have come under a number of brutal attacks against young schoolgirls and the like by not necessarily the Taliban, but by ISIS, and then called now by Hazara leaders then to form their own militia groups to defend themselves. And so we might see that fragmenting more and more along ethnic lines. Some suggestion that President Ghani himself is going to encourage that as sort of a last-ditch attempt to stave off success by the Taliban and the ultimate collapse of the government in Kabul. Some experts now thinking that collapse by the Kabul government that we've supported for two decades could occur within 6 months.
So what do you think we should do in this situation? Do you see a future where perhaps we may have to get re-involved because the situation deteriorates so far?
It depends on your objectives, I think. And the Biden administration has been pretty clear that our objectives are not to make this work for Afghanistan, that it's time for the Afghans to make it work on their own. A meeting occurred about a week ago between President Biden and President Ghani at the White House. It occurred on a Friday afternoon about 3:30, and based on the fact that it was a Friday afternoon, this terrible, terrible catastrophe that occurred in Florida and the ongoing debate over infrastructure, that particular meeting got absolutely zero, best I could tell, coverage by any media outlet. But in that meeting, Mr. Biden did two things. One, he reassured Ghani that we will support you to a degree to the tune of about $260 million in humanitarian assistance and about $3 billion more in security assistance, a lot of which will be paychecks for Afghan soldiers and cops. But beyond that, this is really your fight. And the real question will be whether or not the United States if they see the situation cascading rapidly in provincial capitals or the capital of Kabul being threatened, will the Biden administration use U.S. air power to try to stave off those attacks? There's also going to be a concern as we move ahead, even with the withdrawal. The announcement has been made that we'll retain about 650 American soldiers in Kabul just to defend our diplomats and the embassy, as well as about 1,000 troops, mostly Turkish, some American, to secure the international airport in Kabul, which is a critical lifeline to bring supplies, humanitarian aid, and workers into the country, and obviously would be the ultimate egress point should our diplomatic corps need to flee the capital if, in fact, it was threatened.
That is CBS military analyst and retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland. It was more than 3 years ago when two teen girls were gunned down in front of their apartment complex in a gang-related shooting. There were suspects at the time, but no one had been arrested or charged. That's until now. Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott has details.
It's too much of the young generation dying. There is a gang war going on here, and, you know, there's a lot of people are afraid.
She's just a beautiful human being. She's full of joy. She was full of life. She was laughter.
How many more are going to go?
Gun violence, it breaks my heart. It breaks families apart. We just can't have this.
That was the mood in Burien back in 2018 following the double murder of two teen girls gunned down at their apartment complex. That last voice, Burien Mayor Jimmy Mata. I got a chance to catch up with Mata this week following the news that investigators had made an arrest and charges were being filed for those double murders.
Monday, when I found out that somebody was getting charged, it was a mixed emotion, right? Because at the end of the day, you know, it's another young Latino killing another young Latina.
The girls killed 19-year-old Eviana Cortez and 13-year-old Elizabeth Juarez. Arrested, Francisco Montero, a 21-year-old who was already in prison doing time for a separate murder that happened earlier. At the time of the 2018 double killings, he was 15 years old.
I've been pushing on this, you know, we wanted justice for Elizabeth Juarez and Eviana Cortez, you know, and what the sad part here is this young man was 15 years old when he killed his young lady. You know, it's just incredible to me, but at the end of the day, you know, it's, you know, we want to make sure that this community is safe for all of us, and that's what I've been tackling.
2018 was a terrible year for gun violence in Burien, and Mayor Mata has taken a variety of steps since then to try to change things.
He's setting up programs. You know, we have programs for, you know, I'm working with different organizations like St. Vincent de Paul. They got Centro Rendu that's coming in. You know, we have, we started that parent group. It's called Padres Activos al Futuro. I meet with them every Thursday. So these are mothers, if they're struggling with their children, they come to this meeting and they're able to hear psychologists, they're able to hear different speakers, you know, anger management, drug abuse, so parents can identify when their children may be involved in something they shouldn't.
Mata says,
you know, at the end of the day, you know, we have a lot of challenges in our communities when it comes to drug abuse, when it comes to any kind of side effects of poverty. And so some of these kids are also struggling with, you know, a difference of culture. You know, they're Americans. You know, my mom and dad were born in Guatemala. They weren't born in this country. I was born in this country. This is my country. And so, you know, culturally it is different. And so I'm just going out and, you know, knocking on doors and talking to the community and making sure that when I see a child that's struggling, that we find them help, mental services, you know, mental health services, or it could just be paying the bills, or it could just be just simple things. You know, these kids, we can't even get them into sports because, you know, sometimes we as cities don't have enough money to, you know, hand out those programs for less fortunate people. And so to me, it, you know, who struggles is really, you know, these families, and then these kids end up just not seeing, you know, a light at the end of the tunnel.
One thing he's learned.
We're in a place right now in our society where everything's so polarized. It's ugly. There's no compassion. And what's beautiful about Burien, this has been a community that I have not given up on and I won't give up on, because I do see that there's more compassion than those people that are just pointing fingers and using it for political ploys. You know, here in this community, I've seen the change. You know, we have been stated that we're the second safest city in South King County compared to Normandy Park. But that's been with a lot of work. It hasn't been, you know, by us just sitting on the sidelines and, you know, pointing fingers, we've set up lead programs. We've set community core, co-lead. You know, we have community groups that have set up to be able to help the parents. We have children who now have the Burien Youth Council. We have business on December. I got a call from Padres Ativos al Futuro of a lot of those mothers that were suffering with their children called me that didn't have any gifts. It was on the 24th. I got a list from the city and I was expected to call this whole list. So I picked up the phone, called the Latino businesses in Burien from Empresarios Unidos. Between all of us, we were able to get $1,000. We were able to buy gifts for 32 kids that impacted them. So imagine if you were a kid and you're plagued with poverty. You don't get a gift for Christmas.
And he's also learned some things along the way.
I wish that, you know, somebody would take this bull by the horn, because we cannot continue to lose our children to violence, gun violence specifically. These guns are just getting easier and easier to get to. And since we as a society, we look at guns and we think it's movies. We've been watching too many movies, too many songs.
And Hannah Scott joins us now. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning, Aaron.
A sad, tragic story, but that guy's attitude was inspiring.
He really, really is. I've got to tell you, I met him several years ago. I think it was when the LEAD program, Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion, was being expanded down in Burien. And he's a guy who comes from, he has a background where he's had, as a kid, known folks who were killed by gun violence, but also has had, you know, those involved in gangs in his family. So he's seen both sides of this. He's very passionate about helping the kids and doing things that are productive, keeping the politics of it all out of it, yeah. and really action. He's really very inspiring.
Does he talk about, did he tell you about what he would like, what would help him if there are things? I know he talked about not enough funding for things like sports. Are there any specific things that he's looking to do but can't?
There's, you know, always more investment in things like that at the local level, but he'd like to see a little more action at the state level. He said, you know, state lawmakers have taken some kind of actions to a certain degree, but mostly this last session we were focused on the kind of reimagining of policing and how we deal with those who are already incarcerated and as they reenter society, things like that. He wants to see more investment from the state level in prevention side. And that will circle back to some of what you and I talked about earlier in the week, which is a lot of those community programs where you get it. Really, it is about what is the saying where idle hands, right?
Right.
If you give kids something to do and mentor them and things like that, they won't end up in these situations in the first place. This shooting, by the way, and I don't think I mentioned it in the story, one of the girls killed had been doing some tagging that targeted a rival gang member. That's the guy who was arrested for this. This was over tagging.
Wow.
And that's just a waste.
Yeah, that's terrible. Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you so much, Hannah.
You bet.
Your daily dose of kindness brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. Reliable cars are scarce and expensive right now, but there's a man in South Carolina who's single-handedly changing that by turning over keys and turning around lives. CBS's Mark Strassman has the story.
Elliot Middleton knows his way under a hood at his barbecue restaurant and in his yard, a cemetery of used cars.
You have a car that you're thinking needs to go to the junkyard, contact me first.
This 1990 Mercedes has more than 400,000 miles. Middleton, a trained mechanic, gives clunkers new life and new homes in South Carolina's rural low country.
There's no public transportation, there's no Ubers, there's no taxis or nothing like that.
If you don't have a car out here, you walk.
You walk.
Unless Middleton surprises you with car keys. Single moms, job seekers, older folks with doctor's appointments. 32 rehab cars since last September.
Some folks don't even believe it. It's like, no, that's not my car.
Does every one of these moments give you the best kind of buzz possible?
It's beyond anything in the world.
His father, also a mechanic, taught him about cars and caring. Middleton gifted 5 cars last Christmas. This 2004 Suzuki went to single mom Jessica Litchfield.
This is a lifesaver.
Free of charge.
What?
86-year-old John Darby gets that 1990 Mercedes.
Here are the keys to it.
Thank you.
Turning over cars, turning around lives. Mark Strassman, CBS News, Awandaw, South Carolina.
That is that's a great thing.
I love it. It's so honorable.
I think people, I don't know if people forget, maybe they do, maybe they don't, but the impact that transportation can have on someone's life, like that is such a significant step in helping someone get out of a situation that they're in. If it's, you know, if they're struggling financially, they can get to work on time. They can maybe get a better job that's a little further out because
yeah,
they can get there now. It really is a life changer. And then, you know, you're fixing up some cars. You're
helping people out.
Yeah, helping people out, keeping them out of the dump, wherever you put car, the junkyard,
I guess.
The
junkyard, yeah, sure.
Would be more appropriate. Thank you very much, Katrina. That was super sweet. And now, from the Gian Ursula Show, weekdays, 9 to noon, here on Cairo Radio. He's dancing, he's clapping, mm-hmm. It's G-Sky.
Hey, I'm in here. Wait a minute, we got somebody else with Katrina. It's good to see you in here.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. What's happening, Mace?
I got to talk about these fireworks, if you don't mind, because between the drought and this record-setting heat and these wildfires that are already burning, I feel like maybe, I don't know, they're not the best idea this year, fireworks?
Yeah, blame the millennials.
Okay.
No, that was an inside joke. That was for Katrina right there. I just came
shots
in here.
Fired.
Shots fired, absolutely.
Yeah.
So here's the thing. I am realizing something. I am getting older mm-hmm. by the minute today on Friday. Every single topic has me feeling like an old man. Everything that we're talking about. And all of the young people around me are like, oh, would you just go away somewhere? We'll just retire already. I'm in my 40s. Anyways, I can't stand the fireworks.
Yeah.
They're just not needed. They're just not. Leave it to the professionals.
Uh-huh.
It's so much better
uh-huh.
when the professionals are doing things. Why? Because here's the thing. The people that aren't professionals, they don't just do fireworks between the hours of, let's say, 9:30, 10 o'clock uh-huh. At night until reasonable time of maybe 11:45. No. They want to do fireworks from July 2nd, which is tonight, and then they want to go July 3rd and July 4th.
Yeah.
And let's be real, the worst and was when it's July 5th around 3:30 in the morning.
Dude. Yeah, when they get through they get to the leftover stash.
Right.
Like, hey, man, we got all this stuff we didn't use yesterday.
Right.
And so, yeah, it feels like there's about a week buffer on either side of the holiday where you start hearing things. Down here in East Lake, everybody loves to go down by the water and shoot off these fireworks. And it's like, look, I don't want to like pop the balloons or rain on anybody's parade. Fireworks are fun. I get it. Things go boom. That's exciting. They're bright and colorful and whatever. But you got to be considerate of your neighbors, especially in like high density areas. Pets hate fireworks.
Yeah, drives dogs crazy. It terrifies them.
My cat doesn't like them. Freaks out, like hides somewhere. And there are people who have issues with big, loud noises and things like that. So I don't know.
And there's an addendum this year.
Hmm.
What just happened on June 30th here in the state of Washington?
Freedom.
Right? So just on June 30th, folks are free.
I know. We're all pent up.
So what do you think is about to go down on Sunday?
Oh, dude, boom, boom, boom.
Hospital visits. It's going to be
so if you're listening right now, I know you're saying, gee, you're the person that says get off my lawn. Fair. But can you keep the fireworks off the lawn?
Yeah.
Can you keep the fireworks off the cars, the homes? Yes, take care of these animals. I know I'm complaining, but I'm just saying, I'm just trying to keep it safe. Oh, and one last thing. I know a lot of you guys are going to pull out your phones and you're going to take pictures of the fireworks. Looks good, sounds good, but it doesn't display right like you think on social media. Like, it just doesn't.
Yeah.
Don't do it.
Don't do it, please. It looks bad.
It looks
bad. And can't you see it before you put, you know what I mean? You're looking at it before you post it, I assume. You can't tell that looks horrible? Yeah. I have a question for you. It's more like an etiquette thing.
What do you got?
For all of us who are vaccinated and going to go out and maybe go to like a barbecue, get together,
sure.
That kind of thing.
Sure.
Hypothetically.
Okay.
Let's say I'm throwing a 4th of July barbecue.
Okay.
And the invitation is 4 o'clock.
Okay.
What time do you get there?
I gotta give you two times.
Okay.
If you want to get there before 4 o'clock, that means you've called in advance and say, hey, do you need help?
Uh-huh. Yep.
Right?
Yep.
So you're that person that says, hey, I'm free. You need any help? I can come over.
A little early, help
you
set up.
I'll come over around 2 o'clock to help you set up.
Cool.
You want to be that person. And by the way, if you're the person that doesn't want to bring anything, like if you don't want to bring any food or any dessert, be that person.
Pro tip. That's a great tip.
Right?
Yes.
Be that
contribute
person.
In some way. So help out.
Absolutely. Yep. Now, if you're not that person, which I'm not that person, I'd rather bring something. Then if it starts at 4, then go ahead and get there at 4:45.
Oh, there he goes. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
About 45
I like
minutes.
That. Fashionably late.
Because here's the thing. Even though people say, hey, it's going to be at 4, they're not going to be ready at 4.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
And so they're going to look at you weird if you show up at 4, right?
Dude, 100%. I'm with you. I'm probably in the 4:30, 4:40 mm-hmm. kind of range. But my girlfriend is someone who likes to show up at 4,
mm-hmm.
and it's something that we've had to talk about.
That's me. I'm an on-time type of girl.
Katrina, you're there at 4?
I'm there at 4. I'm helping you out. What do you need in the kitchen? You need something on the grill? I'm there.
I like that.
That's
not bad.
Now see,
different strokes, they say.
That's the thing. I ain't helping you do nothing.
Right.
Because if I wanted to work, I would have had my own get-together. The reason why I'm coming to yours is because I'm lazy. I don't want
to
do anything. Right? Right?
That's
so right. Don't want to be that person. Oh, one last thing.
Yes, sir.
It's summertime. I get it. A lot of you folks, you know, don't wear socks, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's cool. But when you go to somebody else's house, put your socks on.
Are people walking barefoot in people's homes?
What?
G. Scott, okay. Cover your feet.
I'm just saying, cover your feet.
Cover your feet. Stay tuned, everybody. At 9 o'clock, G and Ursula show. The great G. Scott, nice to see you, bud. She was the epitome of a good cop, and yesterday it was a huge turnout at T-Mobile Park for a memorial for fallen Seattle police officer Lexi Harris. Hannah Scott reports.
The stands were packed yesterday in honor of this fallen officer, Lexi Harris. At the podium, speakers included her life partner, Jeremiah Newman.
This is a senseless and awful tragedy. But through all of these terrible waves and pains of heavy emotions, I am so grateful that our last words to each other moments before her death were, I love you.
Harris was killed as she stopped to help with an accident on I-5. One of the drivers involved in that accident was on the run stealing her vehicle after she'd been hit and killed and now is in custody. By all accounts, Officer Harris was what the future of the Seattle Police Department needed to be.
Lexi was an avalanche of good, collecting hope, love, care, change, and loyal participants in her dreams. Lexi wasn't close to done, she was just getting started.
When most people face a seemingly insurmountable challenge, they say, why me? What could I possibly do? When Lexi faces the same challenge, she says, why not me? All of us know what an incredible officer she was, which is why I guess we can't help but liken her to the fitting superhero that inspired her tattoo, Wonder Woman. Yes, she was strong. She was confident and highly capable. But in the 5 years that I had the honor of calling Lexi my friend, I can say with complete certainty that she was certainly human.
This department strives to live up to the example Lexi set. I truly believe in my heart that Lexi's legacy is a guide for the department and for all law enforcement.
And here with us now is Hannah Scott. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning, Aaron.
You know, these things, when they happen, are generally very impactful. I remember there was an officer who died in my hometown when I was a kid, and the outpouring of support from law enforcement, from fire from all over the country coming in. It's really a powerful thing, and it seems like people had so many nice things to say about Officer Harris. Can you share with us the impressions you had yesterday?
Yeah, look, from the get-go, Officer Harris, I had not met her. She'd been with the department 5 years, but as soon as she was killed, I found out a friend of mine, Amari Harris, who did a lot of the coverage during the Amari Salisbury, who did a lot of the protest coverage over the last year with Converge Media. He had done a lot of interviews, and he had sat down for an interview with her that he shared with me. And just listening to that interview, I could tell, and this was maybe almost a year ago, that interview, she was inspirational. She was all of the things that you've been hearing about this past year. When we talk about a national reckoning of reimagining public safety and defunding police and all of these things, all of those criticisms that you hear about police, she was the fix for that. Mm. What she did was all about being inclusive and listening and, repairing the damage between community and police. She was, honestly, I think the best thing the department had going for it.
Wow.
but it really was, I think, clear yesterday that those on the force and those in leadership on the force of the Seattle Police Department want to keep that alive. She had a podcast, that was about that same discussion about she had hard discussions on it about bringing police together and repairing that damage between community and police. So it sounds like Adrian Diaz, the chief, is very much dedicated to keeping that alive moving forward, as is the rest of the department.
Wow. A terrible tragedy. Thank you so much, Hannah.
You bet.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.